Expat Files with John Mueller, Mondays and Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, not the version they give you in those glossy travel magazines or the picture they paint for you in those international traveler websites where they're only trying to sell you something. What's it really like for expats living in Latin America? Well, it's time to take off those rose-colored glasses and find out. So let's get started. In old Spanish lace. Now, I promised you a while back that I'd talk a little bit more about pirating down here in Latin America. And I'm not talking about Johnny Depp here, or the kind of pirating they do around the African coast where they actually hijack ships and take hostages and all that. No, I'm just talking about good old-fashioned pirating of consumer goods and software. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and from what I've seen down here in Latin America, you're never going to stop it. It's just like drugs. No matter how much money you throw at the problem, and how many heads you cut off to Hydra, another two-headed snake grows back. And those two are a lot smarter than the first one. Now, down here in Latin America, it's a huge industry. And it's on every street corner, and the governments just pay lip service to it. And occasionally, only occasionally, they make an example out of someone. And that's only when they catch someone so red-handed that it's so obvious that any two-year-old would arrest the guy and put the cuffs on him. Only then you might see some photo op in the local newspaper with some pompous politicians and some police smiling wildly next to a bulldozer on some street in a big downtown area where they're in the act of crunching 10,000 CDs or DVDs into the dust. And how do they catch these guys? Well, guess what? They don't catch them. I found out by hook and crook and talking to some insiders, it's just another project on the huge to-do list for the police and the so-called criminal investigators down here. Man, that's a joke in itself, but I'll talk about that in another show. And guess what? It's way down on the list, right down there next to jaywalking. So far at the bottom that it almost never gets any attention, unless the authorities stumble on a big mother load that's in some kind of a shipping container and it falls off a truck at the airport and cracks wide open for everyone to see. And then it takes a customs guy to figure out that it's not on the manifest. And only then does it get impounded. And sometimes it doesn't because, you know, there are a lot of bribes going around down here. And there's a lot of officials that work down at the airport and in the customs office. And they only make about $400, $500, or $600 a month, too. They're sitting solidly in the middle class down here. Though, for us first worlders, that's sitting on poverty row. So I ask you, how does a guy making $400, $500, or $600 a month afford to drive a late model car? And not surprisingly, a lot of guys in customs and immigration drive them. Isn't that a coincidence? Now down here, no one pays cash for things like that. None of the locals anyway, who have regular jobs and who can actually afford the payments. Down here, very, very few people have a new or late model car. Only the upper 5% of the population. And somehow, that includes a hell of a lot of government workers. And if you have a newer late model car, you're still going to pay at least $6,000, $7,000, or $8,000 for it, right? And that's for a basic model like a Nissan Sentra or a Toyota Corolla or a Toyota Yaris. Now, bear with me just a little while here because I am trying to make a point. Now, generally, when you pay payments on a $5,000, $6,000, or $7,000 car, a used car even, you're going to pay about $200 to $300 a month for the privilege, not including, of course, insurance, which they'll make you get. And full coverage on a car will cost you anywhere from $35 to $50 a month, even on a late model used car. Even though, like I said in a past show, I always recommend you just carry the basic liability policy, which is only $100 to $150 a year. But I talked about that in detail in a past show, and you can look that up in the archives if you want. But just like in the first world, if you're making payments, you don't have clear title on it. And who's ever holding the note on your car is going to make you carry full coverage in case you get in a wreck or you get it stolen. That way they don't lose their collateral. Anyway, back to the point that these airport officials and customs guys drive nice cars, at least late model cars. And though most of them aren't stupid enough to drive it to work, just like a janitor in the first world wouldn't pull up to work in a Ferrari, which would definitely send tongues wagging amongst the other people who work in the airport who aren't fortunate enough to be in a position to accept bribes, which I'll talk about in a second. Anyway, they have a nice or a late model car at the house, sitting in the driveway, or in the garage. Now, for a guy making $400, $500, or $600 a month, owning a late model car is going to take up more than half of his salary, which doesn't leave much for food or rent or running a household, not to mention gas for that car. So the point I'm making here is that these guys, these bureaucrats, they're in on the pirating. That's how they make extra cash. And when a dubious container makes its way through the borders, they're known to hold out a hand and look the other way. And if you think you're seeing a huge investigative push and a big crackdown, you're mistaken. Anytime you see pirated goods being displayed in the papers or the media, they almost never charge anybody for the crime, but they impound the goods. And somehow, most of those impounded goods always seem to end up back on the street anyway. How'd that happen? Well, it's not hard to guess. They seem to somehow get misplaced, just like the drugs they confiscate down here. And in that case, when they confiscate drugs, it's almost never because of an investigation. It's usually when some truck gets a blowout and crashes, and the police arrive on the scene, and they find 2 tons of cocaine in the back. That's how almost all the big hauls of drugs are confiscated down here. In fact, I can't tell you how many times I've seen in the paper over the years, all throughout Latin America, where a small plane has crashed in the jungle, then it's usually discovered by kids or locals who get to it first. Maybe even days after the crash, they're the ones that pick through it and discover that it's got a hidden compartment or it's jam-packed with cocaine or marijuana or whatever. Then somebody finally calls the police, and when they get to the scene, there's a big media blitz about it, and they stack the bricks of cocaine and marijuana in nice little rows, along with all the guns and ammunition they might find in that plane. And then there's always a few high-ranking police officials that pose like conquering heroes over it. And that's the photo that gets into the evening newspapers. And oftentimes, the DEA makes sure that that photo op gets on the wires and all the international news services get it. Because that, you see, is the only way that the DEA can show the world that it's making a big effort to win the war on drugs. They have to show big quantities sometimes because that's the only way people are going to believe that the war on drugs is actually working. But it's not. When a small plane full of drugs crashes in the jungle, there's always millions and millions of dollars worth of the stuff in it. It's never just a couple of small sacks. It's fully loaded. But you see, you shouldn't let that fool you when you see something like that in a newspaper. Because even though your first thought might be, wow, the DEA and the local law enforcement, they must really have it together. Look at all the stuff they confiscated. Tons of marijuana and cocaine. Maybe they are actually turning the corner and winning the war on drugs. After all, the U.S. is pumping in all that technology and untold billions of dollars every year, right? Wrong. The war on drugs and the war on pirating was lost decades ago. It's such a waste of time, manpower, and money, I just can't believe it. But it's a huge business for both sides, and it keeps a lot of people employed. Now, let me just mention another thing, and I've been told this by someone in the know, too. Someone on the inside at one of the embassies. And he told me that when one of those small planes crashes, and the locals do not get there first, but instead the police or the local military gets there first, often there's a deal made and some cash changes hands, and the drugs go right back to the producer. And that's why police commissioners and generals and colonels always seem to retire rich, especially the ones that are posted out in the boonies, where all those secret narco landing strips seem to be. Now, you really can't keep a thing like that secret for long, can you? Which naturally means the narcos spread a lot of money around to keep a lid on it. And people are poor, so they take it and shut up. So it turns out the only time there seems to be big drug confiscations is when there's a plane crash and the locals find it before the police or the military. When that happens, the drugs can't mysteriously disappear. And that's because these days, every little teenage kid has a cell phone with a camera in it. And when kids start flashing pictures, that often keeps the police from pulling a fast one. And it might seem hard to believe that these kids in the boonies, these poor kids, have cell phones with cameras. And if you don't believe me, just this week I went down and bought a cell phone myself for $20 and it has a camera in it. These days, even down here in Latin America, cell phone and computer technology comes down here so fast, and that's about the only thing that does. Everything else has a delay time of years, believe me. But anyway, so first on the scene, at a crash like that, if it's a local or locals, chances are there's going to be some photos taken on those cell phone cameras. And why not? It's a big event. A plane crash, right? So it's not like the old days when the police and the officials got there and shooed away all the bystanders, and you could bet every time that most of those drugs went missing. And when they did leave some drugs behind to make it look good, the size of the crashed airplane's storage compartment seemed way too big. That is, for the skimpy amount of drugs that came out of it, if you know what I mean. So basically what I'm saying is that police and the military, especially out in the boonies, are often into stealing the drugs themselves and selling them back to the producers. And more often, they steal only part of it. That way they've got something to bring back to headquarters and it looks like they're doing their jobs. That way they make some ready cash, a lot of ready cash, from the guys who lost the plane. And they look good, like heroes on the home front in the process. Now let me mention once again that these big cocaine and marijuana finds that you see in the papers, where you see these unbelievable rows and rows and stacks of cocaine bricks and marijuana bales. Well, let me just clue you in. 95% of the time, that's not due to some brilliant high-tech police work, no. That's the stuff they stumble on when the narcos have a plane crash or a wreck on the highway. And when you read in the papers about other cases where the police seem to be doing great work as they wage valiant battle in the drug war, well, here's another thing you didn't know. They're forever catching idiot smugglers at the airports down here in Latin America. People who try to slip a few ounces or a pound or two of marijuana or cocaine through on or in their bodies or in their luggage. Now, normally at any big airport down here, the scanners and dogs and check-in people are going to catch two or three idiots like that a week because they're using all that high-tech stuff that they got for free from the first world. Well, not exactly free because you paid for it. So there's never a shortage of good publicity for the government people in charge of the drug war when they need it. So anytime up north when it looks like drug war fatigue is setting in with the population and the U.S. taxpayers seem to be getting a little huffy about all the money spent on it and not seeing any results in their own drug-infested neighborhoods, when that happens, every so often you hear rumblings from the taxpayers about loosening penalties and legalizing drugs and stuff, especially out in the western states. But you know, that kind of talk always scares the politicians. They can't have that because it's too big a business. There's too much money for both sides in the drug war. So whenever the public starts making noises like it thinks that the drug war is not working at all and it's time to legalize and tax it, which is the only smart and logical thing to do, but governments were never known to be smart or logical. Anyway, there are thousands and thousands of great airport busts on the books, and that's the DEA and the government's ammunition to show that they're actually winning the war on drugs. Though they're really not, of course. I mean, they can trot out thousands and thousands of photos of idiots who've been busted at airports and border crossings. The airport and border people have seen it all, believe me. And they usually manage to catch most of these idiots. And there are so many arrests every day of the week like that, that it almost looks like the DEA has got things under control and might even be winning that war. But of course, they're only catching the idiots. The smart guys always get through. And in fact, in the last few years, the price of drugs has actually gone down in the first world. And the potency has gone up, which, by the laws of supply and demand, just shows that a greater volume of better-grade stuff is actually getting through. So much for the war on drugs. And related to that, not long ago I was sitting in an expat bar, gathering information, of course, not really enjoying myself. Though I was with expat Eddie, so there was some very amusing moments, I must say. And I hope by now, all you loyal expat file fans out there know, I don't recommend those expat bars. You'll never really get to know a country or its people if you hang around with gringos and first worlders. Not to mention those first world losers that work at the embassies. They hang around at all those expat bars too. And of course you'll meet those military attachés from the first world, some down here officially and some unofficially, some in uniform and some out of uniform, depending on the country and circumstances. But you can always spot an active military guy, even in civilian clothes, you know what I mean? That certain erect posture and the toughness. And the universal military hairdo, of course. Anyway, I was with expat Eddie, in a notorious expat bar. We were sitting next to a U.S. military guy, when suddenly the guy turned to us and said something very unenlightened. The same thing U.S. military guys say to almost all expat Americans, who look like they've been down here a really long time. Like me and expat Eddie. And he said something like,
"Hey, what are you guys doing in this godforsaken place? Pretty far away from home, ain't ya? Bet you're down here for the Chiquitas. Wish I could say that."
Well, the guy was half in the bag and talkative, so I decided to pry a little information out of him if I could. After all, that's why I was at the expat bar. There's a lot of loose lips down there, especially near closing time. So it turns out this guy's a helicopter pilot. And in fact, he's an ex-military helicopter pilot down here on a contract to spray herbicides. Though I think they're not using paraquat anymore. They're using something even better, which means it's about 5 generations more advanced. And that means ever so much worse than the defoilants they sprayed in Vietnam. And to tell you the truth, I don't know why people in the first world aren't talking about it. He tells me the chemicals they use are coming from Bayer and Monsanto and all the biggies up in the first world. All the big herbicide and insecticide companies. I think there's a really good news story in that somewhere. So anyway, he's telling me about his job. He's down here under a first world contract. From what he says, he's making about $100,000 a year. Turns out he's on a list of former helicopter pilots for the military who are on call for third world jobs like this because obviously they pay really big money down here compared to anything he could get up in the first world. I mean, first of all the guy's really qualified for is flying a helicopter. And though there might be some full-time helicopter jobs up in the first world, there are a hell of a lot more qualified helicopter pilots than there are jobs. That's what he tells me anyway. And I can believe that considering the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and you name it. Wherever we're at war, the military cranks out helicopter pilots. And think about this for a second. You can be up in Milwaukee sitting in your backyard all day and maybe see 10 or 15 planes go by, but I bet you 10 to 1 you never see a helicopter. Which I guess proves the guy's point, right? So anyway, this guy's down here spraying some god-awful unknown high-powered chemicals on marijuana and cocaine fields, which I'm sure blow right back in his face sometime, because a helicopter's nothing but a big fan, right? Now, he's not the guy that goes out and looks for them. He's just the guy that gets the information by GPS and goes out and sprays them. And then he says, you know, when I first got the job, I felt a little funny because I like a doobie now and then. You know, it relaxes me. What the hell? I went to college in the 90s, and I mean, everyone did it, except maybe the born-again Christians, but I knew some holy rollers who were sneaking their dope on the side. Anyway, that's what he said. So this half-in-the-bag helicopter pilot tells me and expat Eddie that he felt a little guilty at first, but after a few big paychecks, well, it was just a job. In fact, a very good-paying job, even if he didn't like what he was doing. Even if he got some chronic disease down the road from the overspray. And then he says, before he had this job, he worked for Blackwater. Can you believe that? He was a civilian helicopter pilot contracted through Blackwater right after the first Iraq war. And here's what he said. He said when he went to his interview at Blackwater, the form that he filled out asked him if he'd ever done drugs before and which ones. And he put down that he tried cocaine a few times and he smoked marijuana in college. And he figured he'd better tell the truth because a friend had told him that when you get through the first interview at Blackwater, they give you a lie detector test. Then surprisingly enough, a month later they called him up for the second interview. He went in and took a lie detector test and they asked him again if he'd done any drugs. And he said, yeah, I took a little cocaine, some marijuana in college. And he went back home thinking no way was he going to get selected because they seemed to emphasize that drug-taking question way too much. And he'd admitted it on the written form and during the polygraph test. Then a month later, they called him up and gave him the job. And when he got his orientation classes at Blackwater, he was in the room with about 30 other helicopter pilots. And after the orientation, they went out to get to know each other better, had a few beers, and they all discussed that question about the drugs. And they all admitted the same thing on the form and in the polygraph test, that they'd taken drugs before. To a man, every single one of those pilots had tried illegal drugs. And quite a few of those guys were still using those drugs recreationally, but they never admitted that. And sometime later, by hook and crook, they found out that those psychologists at Blackwater that made up those interviews and tests, they knew that 95% or more of Americans had tried cocaine and marijuana in college or high school. Blackwater wasn't trying to find out if you did drugs or not. What they were trying to find out is if you were a liar. Because it turns out if one of these helicopter pilots would have lied on the written form about the drugs, it would almost disqualify a guy immediately because it's the odd American these days who's never tried drugs at all. So here's the irony. You've got all these pilots under contract to spray herbicides on marijuana and cocaine fields down in Latin America, and the vast majority of them, probably 95% or more, have tried and used illegal drugs, and many are still using, yet they're being paid big money to try to eliminate the very stuff that they like using themselves. Then the helicopter pilot said to me, he said, you know, it would be like working for the feds during Prohibition, busting open whiskey barrels with axes and raiding speakeasies during the day, and then at night, after work, driving up to Canada, where it's legal, partying hard and drinking whiskey till your heart's content. Then the next day, driving back across the U.S. border to your job, smashing whiskey barrels again. The more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess. I know it doesn't make sense, he said, but I get paid big money for it, so I do it. And that's when I asked him the million-dollar question. I said, so how's it working? Are you really eradicating those cocaine and marijuana fields like you're being paid to do? Or are you just going through the motions because the DEA has the budget for it? And you know what he said? He said, man, I have the best job security in the world. It's never going to end. If we had every helicopter ever made up there right now spraying, we still couldn't put a big enough dent in the business for anyone to really notice. And then expat Eddie laughed and put in his 2 cents. He said, you know, up north in the Midwest, you know what it costs for a really good ounce of pot? About $300 or $400 for the really good stuff. And you know what an ounce of pot costs down here? And the pilot said, yeah, sure, about $15 to $25, right? Then he made a sour face and he added this. You know these Latins, they always sell you a short ounce. In fact, it's usually a half ounce or less. But I don't really care. A half ounce for $15 or $25, it's really good stuff. So what's the difference? So even if you figure a half an ounce for $25, that means an ounce is about $50, which is about a sixth of what you pay for the same thing up in the States. And then he said, down here, the other good thing is nobody ever hassles you about it, unless you're so stupid that you light one up right in front of a cop's face. And even then, you might get away with it. In fact, I've never seen anybody get busted for pot or coke down here, except at the airport. The Latin police may be idiots, all right, but they've got dogs, and you can't fool dogs. Now, here's where it got interesting. Expat Eddie chimed in and said, look, you're paying way too much for your pot, man. If you're paying $25 for a half an ounce and $50 for a full ounce, you're getting screwed. And the helicopter pilot's eyes widened, and he said, what do you mean? That's dirt cheap compared to the U.S. And Eddie said, maybe so, but you're paying tourist prices. That's what they charge in the high-volume tourist areas. And in the big city areas, the Zona Vivas and the Zona Rosas, like we're sitting in right now in the expat bar, I bet you buy your stuff from some Latin guy who comes in here and sells it to you, right? And the guy shrugged and said, sometimes. Why not? It's dirt cheap. Come on. And then Eddie said, no offense, but the problem with you guys that hang around in these expat bars is you never get to see the rest of the country, except in your case by helicopter. Where we're sitting down right here at this expat bar, this is not the real Latin America. And in your off hours, you hang around the Zona Rosa and the Zona Viva and the expat bars and stuff. And everything you buy, and I mean everything you buy, you're paying near gringo prices because you're all concentrated in this little area and everybody knows you'll pay. And then Eddie rubbed it in a little bit and he said, do you know what? I get jumbo ounces for $25. I never get shorted. In fact, I always get more than an ounce because my contact is out in the boonies. Now here's the thing for all you expats and expat wannabes and tourists. If you come down to a high-volume tourist area, if you're dressed like a common first-world tourist or a backpacker, especially if you're a backpacker, I'll bet you the first night you're out, if you go out to the tourist bars and mingle with the other first-world tourists and gringos, I'll bet you anything, some local is bound to approach you and offer to sell you some pot, or even some cocaine or some ecstasy. And believe me, you'd be surprised how many tourists, especially young ones, teenagers and people in their 20s, are on the lookout for that kind of stuff because they're on vacation in a tourist town and they just want to party and let loose. And the local hucksters know that. So they'll sell you a bag for $15 or $25. But like Eddie says, you're lucky if you get a half an ounce. And because this stuff is so powerful down here, and so dirt cheap, the locals don't have to stoop to ripping you off with oregano or some other kind of dirt weed, and they know you'll be more than satisfied because they know the real price of marijuana up in the first world, and they're giving it to you at a fifth or a sixth of the price you've been paying for it up north. And they also know that you're going to be a good repeat customer, at least as long as you're down here, and you're going to be partying all the time, and you're going to meet new friends and be with groups of your own people, and the key thing is you're on vacation. So anyway, expat Eddie, who knows about all this stuff, insists that recreational drugs are twice as expensive in the big city and along the tourist trails as they are in the boonies. So the tourists, in effect, are getting ripped off all the time, but they could care less because they're still getting it at a huge discount compared to U.S. prices, which is another example, albeit a strange example, why the cost of living is always cheaper in smaller Latin American towns than in the big cities and in the tourist areas, of course. The fact is, wherever there are gringos and first world tourists, the dollar eventually contaminates the population and some bad effects set in, not the least of which is a predictable hike in prices. But because most prices are so low in Latin America compared to up in the first world, and of course I'm talking about locally produced products and food. Anyway, the point is, even when locals do jack up prices like in Costa Rica and other tourist areas, sometimes you still think you're getting quite a deal. The same thing works, let's say, for hotel prices. Now, suppose you're in a small town in Uruguay, and you're paying $25 a night for a really nice hotel with a nice view. In Costa Rica, you'll spend about $75 for a similar hotel. And in the United States, you might pay $100 or more. And when you get back from your vacation, you're going to tell all your friends about that nice little hotel you stayed at for $75 a night. But it's the guy in Uruguay who really made out now, didn't he? Now, I know I started this conversation today talking about pirating. Well, the reason why I began with that is, in fact, because I came across an article on pirating in the Sunday paper in Panama. And the title of the article says, 8 out of 10 Latin Americans prefer to buy pirated material. And 9 out of 10 Latin Americans don't think that they're breaking the law when they buy pirated goods or falsified goods. And it goes on to say that Latin Americans think, if it's for sale and somebody's selling it, whether in a store or on the street, it's perfectly okay to buy it, even if it's pirated. And they don't look negatively on the person selling it, nor do they think that the seller is a criminal, and they don't think the seller should be punished even if he's the guy doing the pirating. Like, for example, a guy who's downloading movies off the internet, then copying them on DVD and selling them on the street, which is a really obvious case of pirating. Which brings me back to my original statement that pirating is like the drug business. No matter how much money or resources you put into it, you're just never going to get rid of it. Not when people don't think of it as a real punishable crime. Now, here's the funny thing about pirating. Did you know that down here in Latin America, it's not CDs or DVDs or computer software or fake designer label stuff that's pirated the most? You know what it is? Cigarettes. Down here, there's a huge gray market in the buying and selling of cigarettes because tobacco is a huge crop. And if you have tobacco and cigarette making machines, you can put out any kind of cigarettes you want, which means you can falsify any brand. It's easy. Now, the fact is, the local brands, like, for example, Belmont, which you probably never heard of in the first world, cost about $1.50 a pack down here. And a brand name like Kool or Marlboro costs about $2 a pack. So down here, if you can fake a Kool or a Marlboro, you get an extra 50 cents on the deal. But you got the same basic tobacco and product as a Belmont. Now the funny thing about this is that up in the United States, you pay about $5 a pack for cigarettes, don't you? And since they only cost about $1 a pack to produce, about $4 out of that $5 in each pack is direct taxes. Whereas down here in Latin America, they only tax a pack of cigarettes about 50 cents. So you can see how a huge gray market, too, has developed between Latin America and the United States. And most of that stuff slips through the United States on the Gulf side by boat in places like Galveston, New Orleans, and on through Florida. And you know, smuggling untaxed contraband cigarettes up to the United States is not like shipping marijuana or cocaine. The penalty for smuggling cigarettes is almost nothing compared to smuggling drugs. Anyway, I just thought I'd give you a heads up on that, even though I suppose most of you don't smoke cigarettes, and I don't either. But it's interesting to note in Latin America that counterfeiting cigarettes is bigger than software, CD, and DVD, and designer label pirating. And one last note on this marijuana and cocaine thing. I get emails asking about that all the time, so I thought I'd touch on it. I'm not condoning drug use, but I'm a libertarian on that issue. You should be able to put into your body anything you like. It's your body. And as for the so-called drug war, well, that's like shooting an elephant with a pea shooter. And it's the United States that has the pea shooter. So that's pathetic, and it should be phased out, but it won't, because there's vested interest and big money in it on both sides. And a while ago I mentioned the DEA was involved. Well, what's the DEA doing down here? Well, what they do is they train and fund and outfit every little government down here with all the latest high-tech gadgets at the airports, along with dogs and helicopters, of course, another waste of billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars. Because most of the cops down here are crooked. It's not hard to bribe a guy when he's making $400 or $500 a month, which is another reason why the First World will never win the drug war, no matter how much lip service they give it. But just remember, when you come down to Costa Rica or Panama or Acapulco or Cancun or any of the Caribbean island resorts, when a little guy comes up to you and tries to sell you some drugs, no matter how good a deal it seems to you compared to what you paid up in the States, you're paying twice what expat Eddie pays.
South of the border.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Once again, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos. South of the border.